Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The U.S. Navy has ended the search for three sailors missing after a military plane crashed into the Philippine Sea earlier this week. The crash comes near the end of a terrible year for the 7th Fleet. 17 other sailors have died in accidents this year. Meantime, Argentina's Navy continues to search for one of its submarines, which has been missing in the South Atlantic since November 15th. Officials said yesterday that a sound detected during the search came from an explosion, which of course elevated concerns about the fate of the 44 people on board. NPR's Philip Reeves joins us now from Rio de Janeiro. And Philip, have we learned anything more today about what might have caused that explosion?
Well, this was picked up by a couple of listening posts which monitor the ocean, and these are used by the international organization based in Vienna, Austria, that monitors the entire planet for secret atomic tests. Mm. It's got a global network of these posts, and the Argentine Navy says that it's been told that the sound was short, violent, singular, non-nuclear, and consistent with an explosion. And there are a couple of important points here. One is that it happened near the area where the sub, the San Juan, last made contact, a couple of hundred miles off the Argentine coast. It also happened after that last contact on the same day, which was Wednesday the 15th of November. That's 9 days ago. And earlier in the morning of that same day, the captain had reported a problem with the submarine's batteries, describing it as a short circuit. Now, the Argentine Navy says they don't really know what happened. Until they reach some conclusion, the search continues.
And obviously an ominous development for the families who are watching this search effort very, very closely. Are they losing hope at this point?
There are signs that they are. The news was broken to them yesterday of the explosion just before it was publicized to everyone else, and there were harrowing pictures on Argentine TV of family members weeping and hugging and collapsing. Some now say that they're in despair. There was the mother of one of the crew members was on Argentine TV this morning saying at this point she has no hope that any of these submariners will come back. Mm. But that loss of hope, you know, is accompanied by a wave of anger also. Some relatives have begun accusing the authorities of sending their loved ones out in an old vessel in bad repair.
Right.
The San Juan is more than 30 years old. It was built in Germany. And the Argentine Navy insists it was well maintained. It's been through a couple of refits. There's speculation that those refits might have somehow played a role in this disaster, if that explosion was indeed the submarine. Not absolutely decisively proved yet, but very likely. And the relatives are also angry about what they say is a lack of information. They say they're being lied to. And this is becoming a problem for the government of President Mauricio Macri. He came into power saying the military's underfunded and he was going to change that. And now there are reports circulating that he's planning to fire the head of the Navy. And so this story's having political consequences in that country.
Right. And it's been 9 days since the sub was lost. We know there was a 7-day supply of oxygen on board. So the situation, regardless if that explosion had been heard or not, would be desperate at this point. Still, the search goes on. What is happening on that front?
Yeah, the point at which it becomes desperate, and the Navy says it's critical with the oxygen, depends on whether they were able to come to the surface at some point and refresh their oxygen. They can also use a snorkel to do that. But no one knows whether they were able, in which case they are at the point where they would be running out. This is a huge search operation by air and sea. There are at least a dozen nations involved. The US, Brazil, UK, Chile, Russians have just joined. The US military is playing a very large role. Its Navy's using two Poseidon aircraft. It's also got a submarine rescue chamber in the search area, which can dock with a stricken sub at depths of about 850 feet and rescue up to 6 people at a time. Now, depth is a real issue here. The sub went missing in an area where there's a kind of a huge shelf, and the seabed suddenly drops from just a couple of hundred feet in depth to 10,000 feet. If the sub sank to the bottom in the deep area, it would be very hard to get at, let alone to rescue anyone. Actually, the U.S. does have a second, larger rescue chamber, which can operate at 2,000 feet and rescue 16 people at a time. But that's still being loaded onto a ship and isn't due to reach the search zone until Monday.
You know, Philip, as you tell this story, I can't help but think back to 2010 and the Chilean mine disaster, the collapse there. It captivated the hearts of that country. Of course, this story seems like it might have a sadder outcome, but I wonder how the people of Argentina are responding to all this.
Well, it's become a massive issue in Argentina. It's dominating the news, and comparisons are made by the Argentines with the Chilean mine disaster. People are following every single event very, very closely. I was talking to an Argentinian journalist about this a while ago, and he was saying that it's really completely sort of obsessing people because they're so concerned about what's happened here. And as I mentioned earlier, this is going to impact the politics of the country. The government will be criticized over this for the way it's handled the actual disaster itself, and also for the what is perceived as a lack of investment in the military generally.
NPR's Philip Reeves, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And the battle between President Trump and the outspoken father of a UCLA basketball player continues to escalate on Twitter. Yesterday, the president reacted to a Washington Post columnist who had criticized Trump's pattern of attacks on prominent African Americans. Trump then responded by tweeting in all caps, "Make America Great Again." And Twitter, of course, took notice. Let's talk about this and some of the other stories from social media this week with Femi Okeh. She's host of The Stream on Al Jazeera. Hey, Femi, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Peter.
I'm going to let you set this up. Tell us what this fight is all about and why people are reacting so strongly to what the president tweeted.
So LeVar Ball is a dad of a young man that was caught shoplifting in China, and then he was allowed to leave the country with his other colleagues and his peers. But this is no ordinary dad. He's a former basketball player, a former football player, he's a businessman, he's a personality. And this week he was the taunter-in-chief of the commander-in-chief. So President Trump said, "I was responsible for making sure these young men got out of China and weren't in prison." And he says, "Do you think the three UCLA basketball players will say thank you to President Trump? They were headed for 10 years in jail." Then dad, LeVar, jumps on cable news, jumps on TV and says, "Actually, it wasn't you, Mr. President. There were lots of other things that were going on, and I am definitely not saying thank you to me." All caps back on Twitter, "President Trump, it was me. Too bad. LeVar is just a poor man's version of Don King, but without the hair." Now, you've got to admit that actually is quite funny. But
but some people also said there's racial undertones there.
Absolutely. Yeah. And this is where Greg Sargent of The Washington Post comes into the conversation. He deals with political news and he says, "Once again, these rage tweets from the president are part of a pattern. Trump regularly attacks high-profile African-Americans." That tweet, that post, connecting the story and his thoughts to the story, the unpacking of this whole Twitter battle between LeVar Ball and the president, he posted this, and then beneath it, President Trump tweeted in great big letters, all caps, "Make America Great Again." Now, I want to tell you that this was on Thanksgiving Day. Remember that, Thanksgiving Day.
Right.
Shock and support. So, with reactions.
Semi, right. I mean, it has taken a while to unpack that, but telling the whole story is important. And when people saw that Thanksgiving tweet from the president, what I saw on Twitter was people wondering out loud, was that a mistake? Did I really just see that?
Yes. Here's a very appropriate Twitter handle for this story. "Yes, you're racist," says, "How have you still not deleted this?" In capital letters. And Ali Bobali says, "You know, I don't understand how I'm still surprised or that the bar can be lowered, and then I'm surprised that it has been lowered." But also some support for the president. Surfer Mum 75 says, "Much respect to the president, hashtag MAGA." And Battlefront Gen 1 says, nice one, sir. So again, split on social media. The president definitely has his supporters and obviously his detractors.
You know, another story that's getting some attention, a little bit awkward. There's a nude selfie of Republican Texas Congressman Joe Barton going around on social media. Now, the congressman has apologized for this. Some people are questioning his judgment in the first place. But it also comes at a time in this country when many men of power, including in Washington, are being accused of sexual misconduct. But in this case, there's a twist, because there's a possibility that Congressman Barton was the victim in this situation. How are you seeing that go over on social media?
I think the reason why this is important is because any of us who are on social media or might be in relationships with people and we're sharing our pictures with these people, what happens if those pictures then become public, which is what happened with this very intimate selfie? It looked like it was a still from a video, a very personal still from a video. If that goes public without your permission, what rights do we have? That's the key to this story. And attorney Mark Essay says, and he represents a lot of women who are victims of revenge porn, was this revenge porn? Should there be an outcry, or does Barton being a man negate outrage? And I think that's the important thing as we're looking at this story. Should he be considered a victim?
Right. Also, he's a congressman, you know, so the bar might
exactly.
be set a little bit higher. Femi Oke, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Thanks so much, as always.
You're welcome.
And it is the day after Thanksgiving, and if you're lucky, you have a lot of leftovers to get through. Here and now, resident chef Kathy Gunst is with me in the studio, and she is stuffed with ideas for making those leftovers into something new. Kathy, great to see you again.
Hey, Peter. Nice to see you.
Well, I think a lot of people would actually agree with me when I say that Thanksgiving leftovers are the best part of Thanksgiving.
Totally down with you. Absolutely agree. I mean, I always cook Thanksgiving dinner thinking actually about, oh, wow, with the leftover squash, I can do this. With the leftover turkey,
really?
I can do that. Oh, yeah. And, you know, I always want leftovers. It's a long weekend, and there are usually a lot of people around, and we tend to go through them by the next week. By Monday, it's all gone.
How do you make them not taste like leftovers, though?
Okay, great question. So part of it is the mindset that leftover is not necessarily like the most enticing word. Like, I would never put a plate in front of you and say, hey, Peter, here's some leftovers.
Yeah.
But I will say, hey, Peter, here are three dishes I made using the leftovers from my Thanksgiving dinner.
All right. I am looking at this right now.
Of course you are.
Is that some sort of pot pie?
It is. And that is a pretty classic thing to do with leftover turkey. So this is a turkey pot pie. If you've roasted vegetables, you could throw that in. I have parsnips in there, carrots, shallots, leeks, and celery also.
It's beautiful. And actually, it also looks beautiful. You have this perfect
brown crust. It's got a nice crust. So yeah. I made a buttery crust, and it is pretty simple to make. The recipe will be on the website. But I added some fresh thyme to the pastry. So it's an herb-flavored pastry. And then there's herbs in the sauce in the pot pie. So this is a little trick we do to answer your question. We bring fresh new flavors to quote-unquote leftover food.
Right. This looks like a first run, not a day after.
Nothing's supposed to look like a day after. I mean, even your sandwich should look like brand new. Wow, this is a great sandwich. The classic midnight sandwich of, we have Thanksgiving early in the late afternoon. And by the time you've cleaned up and collapsed, sometimes even napped at about 11, my husband's like,
you're ready for the
where's the sandwich?
Yeah. Okay, what else?
So this is really interesting. This is Mapo Tofu. This is a classic Chinese dish that's traditionally made with ground beef or ground pork. And I thought, why not use leftover turkey? So it's tofu and ginger and garlic, and it is spicy.
I'm going to taste it in just a second, but this is an Asian dish. This is the opposite of traditional American.
Absolutely. But this is the thing, particularly about turkey. It is ultimately a fairly neutral flavored meat, and it adapts really well to many cultures and many different ingredients. And I love this. I just chopped some dark meat and some white meat, leftover turkey, sauteed it with ginger and garlic and chili paste, soy sauce, and then added some of my turkey stock. added some tofu, and it's just a simple dish you make in a wok.
Got a good spice to it.
Yeah, it's got a kick. Are you okay?
I'm okay. Now, right. I know that the Japanese slurp their soup, so I'm going to just...
Go for it. Absolutely. It's full of flavor, right? Did you get that slurp?
Yeah. What about the stock? This is good.
This is where you start, really. After you've had your turkey sandwiches, you've sliced off the turkey. So then you have this carcass, and you're going to be tempted to throw it away.
No, don't do that.
Do not. That carcass is filled with flavor. So you put the carcass in a pot. You add carrot, celery, onions, peppercorn, bay leaf. Fill it almost with water, bring it to a boil, lower it, let it simmer for about an hour and a half, and you're going to have a huge pot of beautiful turkey stock, which you can use in the same way that you would use chicken stock.
And you could probably freeze that.
For sure. And my advice is if you freeze it in different sized containers. Sometime you'll want to make ramen, and you'll say, oh, I have homemade turkey stock in the freezer, and you'll want a quart maybe. But I also sometimes will freeze it into those old-fashioned ice cube trays so I can just pop out a little ice cube size of turkey stock. Hmm. So I get to use it for a sauce. The last dish is the most refreshing. So
it's going to be different than the other two. I can tell just by looking at it.
It's going to be super different. So we had roasted butternut and acorn squash from our garden, and it was glazed with maple syrup. So I made a salad with fresh fennel, fresh oranges this season. There's the acorn squash surrounding it. It's got sun-dried cranberries for flavor and sweetness, and it's got pumpkin seeds for a raw crunch.
It is so bright. It is, you know, almost the antithesis of fall, even.
And also of what you think of with leftovers.
And also, I say that not the squash, of course, is very autumnal, but you've got this citrus in there. I think that really just, you know, brings it to
life. It's very bright flavors. Yeah. It's super refreshing. And after all the heavy holiday foods, this salad will be a welcome relief.
So good. Now, before I let you go, I want to ask you a question that I think a lot of people deal with around this time of year. When is it time to just give up on the leftovers? Just get them out of the refrigerator.
You want to pop them into the freezer is what you want to do, because I'm telling you, in mid-January, you're going to be very interested in the fact that there is cooked turkey in your freezer, and you can make mapo tofu, and you can make a pot pie, and you can make this gorgeous salad, and all the other ideas that you can come up with. It's just you're sick of it now. Mm. But boy, in the middle of the winter, it will be a nice surprise in your freezer.
All right. Well, all of this is going to
be. Never give up.
Never give up. I am not going to give up. And in fact, it may be a couple days until I'm hungry again, but that's fine.
Oh, you're easy.
Yeah. We'll have all of these recipes on our website at hereandnow.org. Kathy Gunst, thank you so much.
Thank you. That was delicious. Nice.
All right. First of all, sorry about the slurping there. Secondly, farmers and ranchers would be quick to remind us that they grew the leftovers that we were eating today. And for many of them, it's getting harder and harder to make a living. There are more than 3,000 dairy farms in Vermont in the 1980s. Today, there's just about 800, and 80% of them keep fewer than 200 animals. Steve Zind from Vermont Public Radio has this look at how one small family farm has managed to stay in business.
Puss, puss, puss! You're going the wrong way!
As the last straggling Holsteins plod through a thick soup of brown mud, the afternoon milking gets underway at Silloway Farms in the town of Randolph. The average Vermont dairy farm milks about 160 cows. With 65 milkers, Silloway Farms is small by comparison, but the numbers are still impressive. It takes 600 acres to provide the farm's herd with pasture and winter feed. These cows produce about 1.5 million pounds of milk every year. The milk brings in $300,000 to $400,000 annually.
1940, my parents moved here. Three farmers had gone out of business here before my parents moved in.
David Silloway took over the farm from his parents 30 years ago. Now in his early 70s, he's handed the responsibility to another generation, his son John and nephew Paul Lambert. John and his family live on the farm.
Well, we all work together to make major decisions on the farm, but I'm the one that lives here and the checkbook is here at this house and all the bills come to this house. So I hardly ever leave this place.
In its 77-year history, Silloway Farms has never really faced a financial crisis. David Silloway says that's due partly to circumstance.
Our farm is not a normal farm in that respect, because for years we've gone without any mortgage, without any debt load at all.
The Silloways have also been careful about the choices they've made. As other farms grew and took on more debt, They decided it was better to stay with the same number of cows they've had since the 1970s. They figured expanding would mean taking on long-term debt. So they found other ways to grow the business. Just up the road from the farm, logs are loaded onto a machine that cuts and splits them. The chunks of firewood rattle up a conveyor and into a waiting truck. In 2016, the family's firewood business added another $140,000 to the bottom line, and it's still growing.
At some point, we decided that we did not want to expand the size of the herd. We would expand sugaring or firewood.
The sugaring is separate from the farming, but the two businesses help each other by loaning money back and forth when each needs it. John Siloway says the biggest challenge is juggling finances to compensate for the two big variables in dairy farming, the weather and roller coaster milk prices.
Well, we're always able to pay our bills, but if we have a real good year like 2014, we're able to either pre-buy grain or buy new equipment, whereas in a bad year, we would just, you know, tighten our belts and just get by.
The Siloway farm covers 300 hilly acres. For years, the family leased another 300 acres nearby to get enough hay in for winter. But 2 years ago, the owners of that farm decided to sell the land. And David Siloway says the farm faced a hard choice.
We either had to downsize or buy it.
Which they did.
And that was a $500,000 decision.
The Siloways made another important decision when they decided to transition to organic milk production. They're in the middle of the year-long transition process.
So this is the organic stuff.
It is. $600 a ton right there.
The farm's biggest expense is the grain bill. It was about $100,000 annually, but John Siloway says the organic grain they're feeding costs twice that.
For a real good milk price, it'll be worth it, I guess.
Since this is a small operation, Siloway says hiring workers to help with milking, for example, accounts for only about 10 to 15% of costs. He's confident the farm could survive without transitioning to organic, but more stable organic milk prices mean budgeting and planning could be easier.
We can even plan for retirement, which, you know, a lot of farmers don't even consider that.
Every farm is different in the way it's managed and the economic realities it faces. Siloway Farms has found an approach that has worked for them for three generations. For Here and Now, I'm Steve Zend.
Next few days, if you're watching network TV, you may see this.
Smoking kills, on average, 1,200 Americans every day. More people die every year from smoking than from murder, AIDS, suicide, drugs, car crashes, and alcohol combined.
This smoking causes commercial is funded by big tobacco companies, and they're airing after more than a decade of delay. And for more on this, we're joined by Here and Now media analyst John Carroll. Hey, John, welcome back.
Thank you.
So how did it come to be that big tobacco companies are funding commercials about how bad smoking is?
Yeah, this goes back to 1999. The Department of Justice sued the tobacco companies for billions of dollars for health-related expenses that the federal government puts out in Medicaid payments for smoking-related illnesses. It took until 2006, so a federal judge said yes, found them guilty of racketeering charges. And then for the last 11 years, they've been wrangling over this language. Under racketeering charges, you can't collect money. So the judge said, basically, you need to go out and make these corrective statements and tell the public that you've deceived them and give them the facts about tobacco use and smoking-related illnesses.
Now, I would assume all the ads are true, but how strong are the statements in these ads compared to, say, what the American Cancer Society would advocate for?
They're much weaker. Initially, what they wanted the tobacco companies to say is, we deceived the public. We went out and told Congress under oath that nicotine wasn't addictive or cigarettes weren't addictive. So it's much weaker. That's what they've been wrangling over for the last 11 years. But at this point, they need to run full-page ads in about 50 newspapers over the next 5 months. And they need to run five television spots on the big three networks a television spot five times a week on the big three networks for the next year. So it's a lot of exposure, but it's exposure in media that don't appeal to young people as much as they used to.
Let's talk about that. You've just mentioned newspapers, network TV. I mean, this is just not the way that people, especially young people who might be vulnerable to smoking and starting smoking, that's not how they consume their news content or any of their content. So, you know, will this be effective going through that way?
It'll be effective to some degree, but I mean, the media world has basically changed dramatically since even this ruling was first issued in 2006. So, you know, they said go back to the places where you advertise cigarettes most heavily and then do these corrective statements there. But it's not going to be as effective as it might be. And it's going to be about $30 million, which is lunch money to the tobacco companies.
Sure. Yeah. You know, the companies have said, well, obviously they don't like this. They've said it's a forced public confession designed to shame and humiliate them. Now, say what you will about smoking, but that is an interesting situation to put a company in. Do you think that the message would lose any of its oomph because of the fact that they're just sort of like forced to do it?
Well, I think that's part of it if people know that. But also if you listen to the voiceover, it sounds like a computer-generated voice. Mm-hmm. So it's got this sort of otherworldly kind of feeling to it. And it's going to be out of context. People aren't going to really understand why they're there. They're just going to they're going to see them and they may or may not be effective.
All right. Well, we tried to add some of the context here. Here and now, media analyst John Carroll. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
What kind of TV will you be watching this holiday weekend? We asked NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans to set up a binge-watching menu for us because a lot of us will have some extra time on our hands. And Eric, before we get started on your picks, I want to ask you, as a TV critic, do you have a personal philosophy when it comes to like watching hours and hours of TV?
Well, my own personal philosophy is pick a great TV show and binge watch it. especially over the holidays when you find that you have a lot of time. Like my watching is odd because I'm watching professionally. I'm thinking, oh, I need to catch up with this show or catch up with that show. But that's not I think that's a great idea also for average viewers. So for me, for example, I'm going to be catching up on Better Things, this amazing FX series that is done by this woman named Pamela Adlon. And the reason the show is in the news now is because it's co-produced by Louis C.K. and he co-wrote a lot of the scripts on the show. And so there's a lot of controversy. He's not going to be working on the show in the future, but it is fully Pamela Adlon's show. And it's about this single mom who works as a voiceover actress and an actress who's raising kids on her own. And she's got this eclectic collection of relatives and friends. And it's a very well done series. And I wanted to catch up on it. I didn't have a chance to watch it when it was airing. So I've started binging it now that I have some time off. And so I always suggest that to people, like find a great series that maybe you weren't able to keep up with, whether it's Star Trek Discovery on CBS All Access or This Is Us on NBC. And if you pick the right series, it can really be a lot of fun.
Right. Stay up way too late. Have fun with family or by yourself.
Exactly.
Okay. Let's look at some of the shows you're interested in. You already mentioned one, but what about this new show on Showtime? It's called Ill Behavior. It's got two friends in it who kidnap one of their buddies who refuses to undergo chemotherapy to treat his cancer. It is a comedy. It may not sound like it, but here's a clip.
I haven't been feeling super well lately.
You've been to see a doctor?
Yeah, I have actually. They reckon it's Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Isn't that cancer?
And we don't like to use that word. So negative.
All right, Eric, so it sounds like those actors are from the UK. Is it binge-worthy?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting series. It just started on Showtime, so I've only watched the first couple of episodes. At first, it's hard to even know what it's about because it starts out with a guy who's very despondent because a relationship has ended. But his relationship ended with this woman who has a lot of money, and she gives him $1 million as a settlement in a way. And so he's got money, but then he finds out that the friend that helped him sort of get over this heartache has cancer, but is such a devotee of unorthodox healing techniques, he's not going to get chemotherapy, even though chemotherapy would likely has a 94% success rate with the kind of cancer he has. So he and a mutual best friend of this guy, they decide to kidnap this guy and force him to have chemotherapy. And it is a comedy, believe it or not. But it's really an odd thing. And I think it's kind of perfect to watch over the holidays when you're already feeling a little weird about your family relationships, probably. So this is a great way to watch an even weirder family/friend relationship on television.
So that's a new show, Ill Behavior, if people want to get into something new. But also, this could be a time to catch up on some shows that have already got a season or two under their belts. Maybe you've heard your friends talking about them, and you're like, look, maybe it's time for me to join in on the fun. What about those? You got some recommendations?
Yeah, well, so there's this show on TBS called Search Party, and I named it amongst one of the best shows of 2016 when the first season aired last year. And it was this this really interesting comedy, once again, that doesn't sound like a comedy when you describe it. But basically, these millennials, in particular, one woman who was feeling a little adrift in her life, figured out that an acquaintance from college was missing and sort of dedicated herself to figure out what happened to this woman. Even though they weren't really close friends, this woman had just kind of been nice to her once in college, and she decided she's going to redeem her life by finding this woman. But by the end of the first season, they wind up accidentally killing a man. And so as this new season opens, they've got to figure out what to do with his body, and they've got to figure out how to keep the woman who was missing, who they found, from realizing what had happened. And so once again, these are some very specific characters, but it's wonderful watching them bounce off of each other.
All right. So kind of dark, kind of fun at the same time.
Yeah.
I think we have another piece of tape for a different show. Mike Judge presents Tales from the Tour Bus, an oral history of country music. Let's listen to that.
Hey, Sharon Ray, you're my life.
Johnny Paycheck was a dirt poor kid who pulled himself out of poverty with his music, became a working class hero, and almost killed himself and one other person that we know of in the process.
Eric, tell us about this. Mike Judge, of course, the guy who did King of the Hill, Beavis and Butthead. This is an animated program, right?
Well, it's a really interesting show. Now, this is one of those shows that already aired, but you can catch up on it. So it's an HBO show. And basically, Mike Judge has created this show. If you've ever watched Behind the Music, or if you've watched the show called Unsung on TV One, there's sort of mini documentaries about music stars that maybe are a little off the beaten path, especially on the TV One Unsung. So Mike Judge has done this for country and western kind of stars. And he's picked people like Johnny Paycheck, who had a really infamous history. And he went back and he talked to all of the guys from Johnny Paycheck's backing band. But he tapes all of that. And then he animates the situations. Hmm. And then there's parts of it that aren't animated. It is really interesting. And it's odd in that it's about these artists that aren't necessarily the biggest pop stars in the world. But I mean, he did do Waylon Jennings. Oh. He did do Jerry Lee Lewis. And they're intimate stories told by people who were close to these artists, but it's animated and it adds an extra layer of entertainment. It makes it feel a little more contemporary and a little more absurdist. The humor is a little more absurdist, and it makes it feel like anything can happen, because these guys will tell a story and then they'll dramatize it in the animation in a way that they couldn't do if they were just using film. Huh. So it's a really interesting collection of storytelling techniques that work really surprisingly well.
And in the vein of true stories, why don't we talk about this one on HBO? A new documentary follows Baltimore activists, community members, and police in the wake of Freddie Gray's death. Of course, he died in police custody in 2015. Big news at the time. The film's called Baltimore Rising. Let's listen to that.
And the police and Freddie Gray made eye contact. Freddie Gray ran, and he was arrested essentially for running while black. And he emerged at the end of that ride with an 80% torn spine.
We ain't gonna let this happen no more. We came to send them a strong message that black lives matter.
Eric, sounds like this one is worth our time too.
Yeah, now I know, especially given the velocity of news that happens nowadays, this might feel like it happened a million years ago, but this is a really affecting documentary that was actually directed by Sonia Sohn, who people will recognize as an actress from The Wire. Mm. She decided to go back and spend time with activists who protested in the wake of Freddie Gray's death, but also spend time with police officers. So she spent time with a detective who was investigating, what happened. And she also spent time with an officer who's committed to rebuilding trust between the black communities in Baltimore and the police department. And it will take you back to that time, and it will show you the enormity of the problem that they are struggling with in that town to try and make police more accountable. And it's not the most uplifting thing to watch during the Thanksgiving holiday necessarily. But if you're looking for a great documentary that talks about things that are going on in communities across the country right now, this is a great one.
And it might be something to start a conversation with whoever you're watching it with, too.
For sure. Yeah. Although I guess people want to be careful about the political discussions they're starting at Thanksgiving. This would be a good one at least you have some facts to talk about when you're watching this documentary.
All right. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans giving us some ideas on what to binge watch this Thanksgiving. Thanks so much and happy holidays to you, buddy.
Thanks. Same to you.
Tomorrow marks 1 year since the death of Fidel Castro, the communist revolutionary who governed Cuba for decades. Castro's brother, Raul, succeeded him, but he plans to retire in February. Now, Cuba faces many challenges. It was battered by Hurricane Irma, its economy is falling behind, and there's a tense relationship with the Trump administration. Will Grant is the BBC's correspondent in Havana. And Will, is Raul Castro really going to step aside while the country's still facing down all these issues?
Well, it's certainly expected that he will. He has made it pretty clear that that's his intention for quite a while now. And the sense that we get is that he's simply ready to. He's obviously in his late 80s now. He's 87, and that he is in a position now where he just simply wants to hand over the reins of power.
And the man who will step up behind him is expected to be Miguel Díaz-Canel. What do we know about him?
Right. That's where the smart money is. So he is one of the vice presidents, and he's given his age. He's in his late 50s. He's the one tipped to take over. I think it wouldn't fly very well with the Cuban people if another octogenarian took over at this stage. But it's not impossible, given the relationship with the Trump administration and so on. There is a feeling that, well, we need experience. And of course, that's a big difference when we're talking about the man who's going to lead the nation.
Well, you referenced this relationship with the Trump administration. Of course, President Obama had taken steps to normalize this relationship with Cuba, but the White House now under Trump is walking that back. There's even talk of returning to a Cold War mentality between the two countries. Does that seem like a real risk from your perspective there in Havana?
Well, if we look at this year since Fidel Castro's death, I'd say that's the biggest change. It's simply the relationship with the United States. It's deteriorated so far and so fast. It's made a lot of people's head spin in a way. First off, I mean, just as the funeral was taking place, President or then President-elect Trump issued a tweet calling Fidel Castro a dictator, saying that his legacy was one of great poverty and violence, which, you know, right there and then, that was never going to be forgotten by the Cuban government, let alone forgiven. So that set the tone. And then from there, it's just worsened, really. We've had a very hostile change of policy, drawing back on travel and trade in many in many areas. And of course, there's been this very strange story about the U.S. diplomats in Havana who have been affected, had their hearing affected,
right,
in what the State Department are calling a sonic health attack with some kind of sonic device. And that's taken a poor relationship and plunged it even further into the mire.
Now, the Trump administration says that Cuba has not done enough to protect its diplomats. But do we know really what happened yet? Who is to blame? Is it the government? Is it some sort of hardliners separate from the government that could be responsible for those attacks? We just don't know yet.
It's such a murky story that we just don't know. You're right. On one level, we know that the Cuban government are vociferously defending their own record. They're saying they had absolutely nothing to do with it and that the United States aren't giving them access to those affected or their medical teams so that they can't get to the bottom of what happened, and that they have let the FBI into Cuba, which is pretty unprecedented. Mm-hmm. So that's their defense, that this is all coming from the United States and that they're doubting that it even exists. They put on an hour-long special on state television where at one point they're essentially blaming it on loud crickets outside the homes or the rooms of those affected, which I'm not sure will convince the diplomats or their doctors. It is a very strange situation, and you're right to point out certain things. It could be hardliners who never wanted to see this relationship improve. It could be a third foreign country who want to create a wedge between the United States and Cuba for some reason. And obviously people have looked at the role of Russia in U.S. politics at the moment and wondered if that has anything to do with it. I think what we can say is the following, is that if this was designed to do that, i.e. to push a wedge between the US and Cuba, to block this engagement, this policy of engagement, to block this new sense of friendship, well, then it's definitely working.
So those are the diplomatic concerns, but there are also other real concerns, economic concerns on the ground in Cuba. Hurricane Irma hit the country hard. The country's in the middle of a drought. Its relationship with Venezuela and the oil supply is in doubt. A year after Fidel Castro's death, how are the people in Cuba feeling about their fate?
I think that's a really decent point about Hurricane Irma, is because I think that's when a lot of ordinary Cubans felt the absence of Fidel Castro. But yes, obviously the economic consequences of that have been significant. It's had a real hit on tourism. The economic consequences of the new travel advice to Americans from the Trump administration will also take a hit on tourism. And of course, the absolute dire economic situation of Venezuela is really having an effect in Cuba too. And it does create a bit of uncertainty, quite a bit of uncertainty, when you think that it's leading up to Raul Castro stepping down.
The BBC's Will Grant in Havana, 1 year after the death of Fidel Castro. Will, thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. Robin and Jeremy are back on Monday. I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.